trying to keep on schedule as much as possible. We have a busy day for you. We have our regular plenary sessions at 9 and tutorial sessions at 10:15 to 11:45. Then we'll invite you back into this tent or into the tents in front of Pepke Auditorium for lunch. At 12:45, we will start moving people over to the music tent for our session, which will be all afternoon in the Aspen Music Festival's tent. They've been very gracious to give us that this afternoon. And as if you've reviewed your program, it's a stellar lineup that includes Justices Breyer and O'Connor and Alan Greenspan and Norman Lear and T.D. Jakes and Brian Greene and Nora Ephron. I mean, I think you're really in for a treat. I wanted to tell you that after the plenary today, we will be distributing, this morning's plenary, we'll be distributing evaluations, and we'd love to have you take a look at that, those this morning and deposit them back at Pepke Auditorium so we get a good sense of how your few days with the Aspen Ideas Festival have run. We really appreciate your feedback, and it's actually critical to us. There is one session that's canceled this morning, and that was going to be in the Marble Garden at 10:15. Unfortunately, our speakers had to drop out this morning for travel reasons, and so we will not do the session that's memorable events that changed your life. And just to close, on behalf of all of us at the Aspen Institute, because we won't really have this opportunity again in a big group, I want to thank you for joining us at the Aspen Ideas Festival. You've been here with us for a few days. You have a great day ahead of you. Your support's incredibly invaluable to us, and we really appreciate the fact that you are here, and I hope you've had a great time. Thanks.
And good morning. I'm Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm publisher of The Atlantic, and I'll add my thanks to Kitty's as well, and hope you've enjoyed your time here with us. This morning's session is part of our State of Environment track, sponsored by GE, General Electric, and we're very happy to have them and their executives here with us this morning, too. We have as our moderator Andrew Shapiro, who is CEO and founder of Green Order, which is an environmental and sustainability strategy and marketing firm. And Andrew has all of the Ivies covered. I'll tell you a little bit about his background, then he'll introduce our panels and get this morning's session going on Making Green Green, Can Corporations Profit from Environmental Leadership? I noticed in looking at your bio, Andrew, that you have all of the Ivies covered. So he is a graduate of Brown and of Yale Law School, but is also a lecturer at Columbia and at Yale Law School and a research fellow at Harvard. He's a project director with the Aspen Institute and a senior advisor to the Markle Foundation, a published author, and he served recently on the Environmental Advisory Committee for both the New York City 2012 Olympic bid and the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, and has been named as one of 100 young innovators who will shape the future of technology by MIT's Technology Review. So thank you to Andrew for leading our session. I'll turn things over to you.
Thank you. Is everybody here? Good. Good morning. Welcome to the first plenary of the day. I'm glad you could all make it. That was a very kind introduction. The only thing wrong with it was all the tenses, those things I've done over the last 10 years, but it may be only a statement about the fact that I can't really hold a job. So this is a really terrific panel, and I'm going to start out. The other thing that wasn't mentioned is I've had the honor of working at the Aspen Institute for 8 years as a moderator of seminars. And so I come with the approach of a Socratic dialogue and trying to be neutral and get at the truth. On the other hand, I have to tell you the truth that I come into this discussion and panel with a lot of bias, a lot of bias. The very question that we're going to address is whether companies can align profit motive with sustainability, environmental sustainability, is one that I've sort of answered. I think not only can companies do it, but we have to do it. That said, we're going to use this opportunity because we have three terrific panelists to really mine the depths of this issue, figure out where businesses can take advantage of environmental leadership to prosper, to differentiate themselves, and to really do well, and where the pitfalls are, because there are pitfalls as well, and we want to use the tremendous experience that we have with these three outstanding panelists, who I'll tell you a little bit about right now. Their bios are in your book, and I'm not going to go through them in terrific depth, but I encourage you to look at them. Ray Anderson, who's right here next to me, is the chairman and CEO of Interface. Interface is one of the leading carpet and textile companies in the world, and Ray has been a pioneer in sustainable business for a dozen years. He'll tell us a little bit more about that, but since the mid-90s, he's been rethinking the entire industrial process as it relates to his industry, and he has really set Interface apart, not only in the textile industry, but in corporate America at large. Lorraine Balsinger is the Vice President of Eco-Imagination at General Electric. A little bit more of the bias here. I've known Lorraine as a friend and colleague and client, and GE is doing some tremendous things on energy and environmental issues, which we'll explore more here today. Lorraine has a 20-plus year record at GE. She comes from an engineering and marketing background. In fact, when Jeff Immelt chose her to run Eco-Imagination, she had previously been running sales and marketing of aircraft engines, so she knows a thing or two about driving a business and driving profit. John Doerr, I probably don't need to introduce to most of you here. In addition to being a trustee here at the Institute, he's a storied venture capitalist and a partner in Kleiner Perkins in Silicon Valley. He's been a backer of some of the most successful information technology companies, Sun, Amazon, Google among them, and in recent years has gotten quite involved and interested in green technology, and we're delighted to have John join us to talk a little bit about the other side of the business landscape with early stage startups, but also to give his perspective on what's happening in corporate America broadly. So let me give a two-minute précis and then tell you how I'm going to organize this discussion. We're going to dig in with each of the panelists for about 5 to 10 minutes to understand their perspective on the question, which is, how can businesses align profit with sustainability? Before we do so, let me give you the landscape as I quickly see it. 2005 was a watershed year for business and the environment, a watershed year, not only because of the actions of companies like GE and Walmart and Goldman Sachs and so many others, but because of a new consciousness and thinking about the environment by corporate leaders. I think of it as the third wave of consciousness or thinking about business and the environment. The first, very familiar to us. Up through the late 90s, most companies saw the environment, if they thought about it at all, as simply a cost. They thought it was something you focused on only for the purposes of compliance, and they relegated it to parts of the company that, frankly, were not that strategic. Then you entered a second wave where some companies started to be a little bit more accommodationist, say we recognize that the environment is an important issue in terms of scarce resources and the expectations of stakeholders, ranging from investors to customers to employees. But still, there were few companies that were truly at the vanguard, maybe with the exception of Interface and others, in terms of seeing the environment as a source of business value. And that is what distinguishes the third wave of thinking about business and the environment that I believe we're entering now. And that third wave is characterized by business leaders who look at sustainability issues as an opportunity. They see a source of innovation, they see a source of competitive advantage, and they see a source of long-term profit and enterprise value. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Now, in the public landscape, a lot of you probably read Tom Friedman, who said that green is the new red, white, and blue, thinking about why we need, as a country, to be leaders on energy and environmental issues because of issues of national security and resource competition and so forth. The New York Times, after the Vanity Fair green issue, said green is the new black, meaning it's sexy and hip and in. But what we're here to discover is whether green is the new green, which is to say whether environmental leadership in business can be the source of profit and growth. So, Ray Anderson, let me start with you, because you've been doing this, as we said, for a dozen years. Tell us a little bit about Interface and your green initiatives, the products that you have that are innovative from an environmental perspective. And let's start with, you know, the epiphany moment that you had that actually led you to write this book, and you should hold it up for people, mid-course correction. But tell us about the beginning, Ray.
Well, thank you, Andrew. The summer of 1994, we began to hear a question from some of our customers that we'd never heard before. At that point, Interface was 21 years old. I had founded it in 1973 from absolute scratch. It had grown to be a success by anybody's standard definition of success. But in 1994, a new definition of success began to creep into the picture. These customers were asking the question we'd never heard before: what's your company doing for the environment? And we frankly had no answers. For 21 years, I had never given a thought to what we were doing to the earth in the making of our products, or taking from the earth in the making of our products. But the question kept coming, and the group in our company were very uncomfortable because we couldn't give real answers. The real answer was nothing. So one of our senior executives said we ought to form an environmental task force, bring people from our businesses around the world. By this time, Interface was a globally positioned company. And let's assess our company's environmental efforts. What are we doing? What are our policies? What can we say to these customers? So they set the date for the meeting, August 31, 1994. And they, about the middle of July, they asked me if I would come and speak to this new task force and launch it with my environmental vision. Well, I didn't have an environmental vision, and I didn't want to make that speech, and I drugged my feet, but they stayed on my case. And finally, I relented, said, okay, and then I started to sweat. I could not get beyond, we obey the law, comply. But they, you know, the meeting was coming, and I was sweating, and one day, about the middle of August, this book landed on my desk, The Ecology of Commerce, written by Paul Hawken. I had no idea who Paul Hawken was, knew nothing about the book, and I began to thumb it in an idle sort of way. And on page 17, I came to a chapter heading, The Death of Birth. That was an arresting moment for me, and I began to read, and I very quickly came upon words and concepts I'd never, ever thought of before: carrying capacity, overshoot, collapse, and, of course, extinction, the death of birth. Well, in about 10 pages, I was convicted as a plunderer of the earth. Hawken made his central point in three parts. One, the living systems, the life support systems of earth are in decline. We are badly damaging the biosphere. Secondly, the major culprit in this decline is the industrial system. This linear take, make, waste industrial system of which we're all a part. And thirdly, the only institution on earth that's large enough and powerful enough, pervasive enough, wealthy enough, and influential enough to really lead humankind out of the mess that it's making for itself is this same institution that's doing the greatest damage, the institution of business and industry, my institution. And that was a convicting moment, and I took that message very, very seriously. I spoke to that little task force, and I used Hawken's material, and I challenged them to lead our company to sustainability and beyond, to make Interface in Time a restorative company, putting back more than we take and doing good for Earth, not just no harm. Now, we're a petro-intensive company. You might even look at Interface and say, you're an extension of the petrochemical industry, and we are, and we were then to a much greater extent. 12 years later, you know, I can report remarkable results, but they came, you know, one idea, one person's changed mind at a time. And in time, an entire company has come aboard, and some of the results are just remarkable. Our greenhouse gas production in absolute tonnage is down 56%. Kyoto is about 7% by 2012. Come on. Our products are the best they've ever been, and maybe I can elaborate later on that. Our people are galvanized around this higher purpose. Abraham Maslow had it right when he said, at the top of this hierarchy of human needs is the need for self-actualization, and this translates into higher purpose. And it's a galvanizing effect. You can't beat it for bringing people together or attracting better people to the company. And the goodwill of the marketplace has been absolutely remarkable. The same customers who were asking those questions in 1994 have embraced the company for what we're trying to do. And we framed it in terms of climbing a mountain higher than Everest, Mount Sustainability. That point at the top symbolizing the zero environmental impact, zero footprint that we aspire to, and we think we can get there, literally, by the year 2020. At this point, we're about 40% of the way.
And by 2020, just to give people a perspective, and it's worth looking at Interface's website to get the exact details of this, But Ray aims to take Interphase to the point where I believe you said you want to have no negative environmental impact by 2020. So here's one I want to press you a bit. How have you measured the business value that you've derived from, clearly you're a leader on environmental stewardship. How have you seen that translate into business value? How do you measure it? You've had a dozen years of experience now.
Yep.
And are the metrics that you're using validated by Wall Street and outside observers?
Right. The business case for sustainability, as it has developed for us, is very clear. One, our costs are down, not up. Dispelling that myth that there's a choice. There's a false choice, in fact, between the economy and the environment. We've saved over the 11 years for which we've been measuring something like $300 million in waste elimination alone, more than paying for all the rest of the initiatives that we've undertaken. That $300 million represents 28% of operating income over the 11-year period. Our products are the best they've ever been, and because our lead product designer read a book himself, Janine Benyus's book, Biomimicry. And Janine is going to be here, I think, speaking tomorrow. Don't miss her. She's wonderful. Well, he read a book, and he was turned on beyond even what I had been with mid-course correction. And our people are galvanized around this higher purpose and the goodwill of the marketplace. I don't know what else there is in terms of creating shareholder value. The business case is very clear for us, and in spite of the $300 million of cost reduction that we can point to, far and away greater is the impact or the effect on our top line from the customer goodwill.
Can you just say a little bit about that before we move on? Is there a way to quantify what that growth in the top line has been?
I cannot, because sustainability now is just infused throughout our company. It pervades everything we do. And you can't pick this out and say, well, this is responsible for that anymore.
But you have greener products
in
the market.
We have greener products. That reduced footprint.
Do you find that they're getting more demand or a premium in the market?
Yeah, with today we're selling climate neutral carpet. And how we got to that is a long story you don't have time for me to tell. But the idea of a petrochemical product that throughout its entire supply chain, the entire production process, including suppliers, all the way back to the wellhead, is climate neutral in its production. And we call it cool carpet. And our customers love it. And that's only one example. If I do have time, I know I'm monopolizing the conversation here. If I do have time, I want to tell you about another product innovation that came out of biomimicry.
Good. We'll come back to that. Lorraine, in some ways, the Interphase story and the GE story are sort of bookends to business and sustainability over the last decade. GE launched EcoImagination in May of 2005. It is an initiative that's gotten a lot of attention. Tell us a little bit about the components, because some of the folks here probably have seen the advertisements with the dancing elephants, but this is a business growth initiative. And tell us sort of what it's about, how it was driven in the company, what the drivers of this initiative were, and where it's going.
Sure. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. And first, I want to thank Ray for leading the way, because we need pioneers a decade ago so that it is a little easier and the vision for us can be somewhat clearer. EcoImagination, first, let me tell you what that term of art means. We carefully chose it because we've launched a new branding campaign across GE called Imagination at Work, the idea that imaginative and innovative ideas can actually work and our people work at them. The eco piece of it is actually a term of art for two things. One, marrying the ecology or the environment as well as economic. And you'll find threaded through everything that we do that we believe there has to be a balance, that in order for EcoImagination to live as a real initiative and as a business strategy, it has to appeal to both the economic side as well as the environmental side. So when we launched EcoImagination, we said, this is, for us, a growth strategy. We have to have smart commitments that our employees can grab a hold of and do something about, that our shareholders will embrace and say, we think this is a good use of the company resources, but perhaps most importantly, that our customers say, we'll buy. And I would say probably our initiative was most informed by the markets that we serve and the customers that we serve. And those customers said, we understand this take, make, waste issue, and we have to grow sustainably. There's not an option for us to sort of halt our growth. So you need to try to help us figure out how to do this. We have environmental challenges around water, both scarcity and water reuse and waste, around energy and energy intensity, whether it's the aviation business, which we serve, or the power generation business that we serve. We have issues around fuel diversity and security, and we'd like to have alternatives. So this was very much a market-backed voice that came to us and said, we need you to help us with these issues. And by the way, you have products in all these markets. So if you think about the markets that are served, aviation, our plastics business, our consumer and industrial business that makes lighting and motors, these were all platforms, and energy, of course. These were all platforms that we did, in fact, already play in and had for decades. And we found that it was an opportunity for us to change the way those platforms and those markets would, in fact, make money or spend money. So we decided that it was important for us to have some very firm commitments and not simply a branding campaign, not simply the dancing elephant. We love the dancing elephant, and I hope all of you do too. But to be honest, I mean, without something more concrete behind it, and I'd warn anyone against this, it could be perceived as greenwash, and that's death. So for us, we said it has to be a business growth strategy that we can put some teeth behind. And the four commitments that we made was, first, that we would increase our research and development dollars and in green technology from about $700 million a year to $1.5 billion a year by the year 2010. So to me, that is probably the most concrete, actionable thing when you say, what have you done? When you put resources into something and you say, this is the money that we will spend in growing our portfolio of products that can serve this marketplace, I think that that speaks volumes as to the commitment of the company. The second was to increase our revenues, because our shareholders want to know, well, what is the output of this increase in investment? What's my payback? And so we have committed that we will double our revenues from about $10 billion to $20 billion by the year 2010. Our third commitment was to reduce our own greenhouse gases and energy intensity, and we feel that's important for two reasons. The first, to lead by example. If we tell others that this technology is good, then we better be willing to take our own medicine. And secondly, and as a marketer, you can imagine this might be more near and dear to my heart, I can use our operations as showcases to show the world that this is a great thing. We've done it ourselves. Very simple example, we believe it or not, in our lighting business, we have about 154 facilities across the company that do something with our lighting business. We weren't using our own most efficient fluorescent light bulbs. Please don't tell everyone that when you leave here. I'm a little embarrassed by that myself. Now, we had efficient light bulbs, but they weren't the most efficient light bulbs. So we said, what if we were to say it's a mandate, we're going to change them all out? Well, we did that, and let me just tell you what's the results of the first 20. So the first 20 facilities, we are saving $2 million a year annually. We are reducing greenhouse gases to the extent of about 3,500 cars off the road, because if I tell you tons, that's a number that gets sort of lost. And we get a showcase to tell our customers, come and see what we've done. We've gotten productivity improvements. I walked one of the shops, and unheard of in an industry, some of the union people walked up to me and said, this is the best thing you ever did for this facility. I didn't personally do it, but it was just absolutely a wonderful productivity play as well. The fourth thing that we said we'd do is to keep the public informed, and I think that's important. Once you step out on this limb and sort of state that these are your intentions, I think it's important to say, what progress are you making, and how far have you come? So we will continue to do that. I think the motivation, Andrew, will always go back to, is that our motivation was the marketplace, and it was our customers who said, we want both environmentally sound products and we want economically better products. So, and we have very good competitors in every market that we serve, so we always have to be that much ahead of the game. I think our cheerleader and our head has always been Jeff Immelt. I mean, he had this vision. He spends a lot of time with customers.
He's the chairman of the company.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Chairman and cheerleader.
Yes. Maybe I'm his cheerleader. I don't know. He's the quarterback for sure. But they're unquestionably, he leads it from the top. And I think across the company, Initially, it was Beth Comstock, who was here with us last year. She was our chief marketing officer for the company. She's now running one of our businesses. But then all of the chief marketing officers through all the businesses and their CEOs got on board. And I have to tell you, it's been very easy to convince people that they need to sort of be motivated by this. In fact, it's the opposite. It's very grassroots, and our colleagues and employees have just absolutely loved the initiative.
So two quick things. What does it mean that at GE, Jeff Immelt asked yourself, a marketing executive who ran a big division and sales for that division, and Beth Comstock before you, the chief marketing officer for corporate, to lead this initiative, as opposed to giving this initiative to the head of environmental affairs or the chief environmental professional in the company? What does that mean more broadly for this concept that businesses can align profit and sustainability? And second, what incremental value is GE seeing? Because as folks know, a lot of these product areas, wind turbines and cleaner coal and water filtration and even energy efficient appliances, you were doing already. So how do you talk about wrapping things up in a way that adds incremental value?
Great. First, without any disdain whatsoever for my partners in environmental health and safety, because they are absolutely my partners in this. I can't do this without them. And I think of there's a triumvirate of sort of power brokering going on. The first is our environmental health and safety people who keep me on the straight and narrow and have worked with the NGOs for years and years on environmental issues. So they're my right hand. And my left hand are the business leaders, because without them, nothing gets done. I mean, I don't have a huge team, and I think that's exactly the way I want it. I have a few folks that help me. I have some corporate communications folks, and I have a lead in each one of the businesses, because the fact of the matter is that's where the business gets done. That's who funds the next generation of products. So I think what it, you know, what does it mean to have sort of this singular person who oversees it? I think it is just that I oversee that it continues the momentum and that it has voice. Just on the phone with Jeff this morning about some legislative issues that we have to deal with. So it has a sort of a an anchor, but that anchor isn't to weigh it down, which I think if you were to relegate this to an EHS niche part of the company or give it the sort of mindset that it's a compliance issue, then you miss the entire point that this is a growth strategy and a market-driven strategy. So I think that's what the difference is. When Jeff says, let me pick someone who's done product development, who's worked in a business, and who has a marketing head, he's saying this is about external focus, not sort of the narrow compliance focus that perhaps past environmental programs have had. I'd say your second question, well, you better give me that second question again. What
incremental value?
I can only measure it in terms of what the marketplace tells. I think there's lots of metrics, but first I look at what's happened to the order book on EcoImagination products. And from 2004 to 2005, those products have doubled from $9 billion worth of orders to $17 billion. So that's nearly a doubling. That's very gratifying, and I think it is the marketplace that gets to vote, and they voted with their wallets. They had choices of products to make, but they chose products that were EcoImagination products. I'd say the other incremental value, which is a bottom line kind of value, is the benefit of us taking on our own greenhouse gases and energy usage reductions is going to yield about $100 million annually to the bottom line. Now, you think about what it takes to create a $100 million worth of profit business. That's a very, very large business, and we're going to do that every single year. So I'd say those two things are the incremental value that will be created.
Great. We have a little cutting of the green behind us. John Doerr.
Is this on? Can we go back to one thing, though? You talk about green. To go from $7 billion to $18 billion worth of orders, that's really big money. That's remarkable. Yeah. In a couple of years, right?
One year.
You know, we can close down the panel.
Yeah. Anybody not convinced? Well, we'll get your question in a bit. So, John, let's take your perspective, because you've been all over the tech landscape.
Yeah, wandering.
And had the opportunity to work with some of the bigger players, the Suns and Amazons and Googles and others, Intel, but also now with early stage companies, with entrepreneurs, and the perspective of a venture capitalist investor we're really asking the same question, right? For big business, can you align environmental leadership with profitability? And for early stage investors and new growth of companies, can you align those things? Tell us a little bit about the new green tech portfolio that you're investing in at Kleiner and your broader perspective on business and the environment.
Great. I'm happy to do that. And I also think we're it's a wonderful indulgence to have someone as articulate as Andrew who's leading this conversation along. I think he's going to drill us down deeply into these issues. And the way Kleiner Perkins became more than interested, really committed to this, was under the influence of a lot of thought leaders. We're listening really all the time and don't have a lot of truly original ideas in our partnership. And so every year we sit down and talk with Bill Joy, for example, who joined our firm a couple years ago, a year and a half ago, and he joined to work on green, to work on sustainability, not computer science or the internet. And then it was 2 winters ago when we sit regularly with Tom Friedman. 2 years ago, he said, green's the next red, white, and blue. And so he framed this Al Gore sustainability issue around geopolitics, tough-minded profitability, America's economic and national security, as well as the threat that sustainability posed to our environment. And he asked a lot of questions about innovation and entrepreneurs, why there isn't a Moore's Law that's been animating and driving this industry. And then we said, all right, we'll take the Kleiner partnership, which historically has done well in both life science innovation and information technology innovation, sort of bugs and drugs and bits and bytes, and we'll add a third leg to that stool. And that's going to be in and around not energy, not clean tech, but green. All the places for innovation, from conservation to generation to transmission to clean water. And we quietly, I see my partner Vinod Khosal out here, began quietly making some investments in transportation, solid oxide fuel cells, and the snowball grew. You know, it just gained more and more momentum and opportunity until this year in February we said, you know, we're going to earmark, like they do in Congress, at least $100 million of our investing activity to this third leg of the stool. And it's grown to be bigger than that. So you look at GE's data, you go to China, the wealthiest entrepreneur in China is a guy who founded a solar panel venture.
SunTech Power.
SunTech Power. The most successful initial public offerings in the last year are solar-related projects. You look at the enormous enthusiasm and leadership there is around biofuels, and you'd have to be dumb as a doorpost not to say this is an opportunity to be successful and, as they say at the Aspen Institute, to do work that is significant.
John, let me ask you about the policy landscape, because one of the things you're known for is bringing your passion for innovation from the business world into the policy world. You've done it in healthcare, you've done it with pandemics, education, and now I know you've got some irons in the fire on the environment side. I think I read on one of the blogs, not sure if this is apocryphal or not, that the end of oil line and the president's State of the Union, excuse me, the oil addiction line was somewhat attributable to you and colleagues of yours. But how important is the policy landscape in terms of making green green, in terms of making environmental leadership a source of profit and value for business? I mean, thinking about things like the trading of carbon dioxide emissions allowances or simply the subsidies that exist in the existing infrastructure for petroleum-based transportation and electricity mm-hmm. generation. Mm-hmm.
That's a really good question because there's some who are really not just well-meaning, smart people who say, we have all the innovation we need right now. Robert Sokolow, who's in a panel, I think, tomorrow, published a landmark paper out of Princeton that says, to deal with greenhouse gas emissions, there's some 15 or so policy wedges, and all we need to do is adopt, say, 11 of those, and we're home free. We'll have done our job. Don't need any innovation. But some of his policy wedges, for example, one of them is that we'll convince Americans and Chinese to drive less. And, you know, I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime or my kids' lifetime. So, as usual, the answer isn't either or. It's a yes. It's a both and also. And so we feel we have to work in the policy world to Energy, for example, is a highly regulated, policy-sensitive industry. You were on the phone talking with Jeff today about policy issues and also the world of innovation.
Are you comfortable, though, as an investor, being in sectors like solar, for example, which we all can concede today does not, the economics of solar don't work without incentives and subsidies? Does that make you comfortable as an investor?
Yes, we're willing to take that risk. One, by engaging in the policy landscape, I think we don't know exactly what the laws will be, but we can see and influence what the aperture is. I think we'll have what they call carbon constraints. I think there will continue to be incentives for solar. But the other thing is you have to shoot a little bit ahead of the duck here. You know, when you backed a couple of dropouts from Stanford who had a wonderful search engine and no idea how to make money, you sort of felt that some of those cards would turn over. Or the folks who made the first web browser and didn't know how to make money at Netscape, and lo and behold, they did.
Great. Ray, let's talk about some of the pitfalls. You've been at this now for a dozen years. It can't be a simple linear narrative of, you know, you get religion on environment and then your business grows as a result. Where are the difficulties? Is it in trying to convince your colleagues in business? Is it with the customer landscape, the investor world? What are the difficulties in this, and what lessons have you learned that you can impart to this group?
Well, for sure, nobody's born knowing this stuff. So everybody begins wondering, what the hell are we talking about? And to get a clear vision of where we want to go, and then to share that vision consistently, persistently, year after year after year, is a demanding thing for any leader. And to bring people aboard who don't know what this word even means, this word sustainability. So the challenge for me personally was to speak to our people at every opportunity, factory meetings, sales meetings, anytime there were groups of people coming together. I was there telling them we have to do this and telling them why. The earth is hurting, you know, and we're part of the problem. We have to be part of the solution. So really getting people aboard is by far the most difficult challenge. The other challenge is that when we began, the technology simply didn't exist. And one by one, they fall into place, and we still have a long way to go on the technological front. For example, the most energy-intensive and valuable single raw material component in our products is nylon of the type 6-6, which refers to the molecular structure of the nylon. And no one, including DuPont, anybody else, has figured out how to recycle and close the loop on nylon 6-6. So this is a huge challenge that remains. We either figure that out or we find a substitute. But one way or the other, we will, you know, we're going to move through that particular problem. So fundamentally, it's one mind at a time, and it's one technology at a time. Those are the challenges. And of course, along the way, you have all the vicissitudes of the marketplace. We've been through a four-year-long recession that saw our primary marketplace decline 36% from peak to trough. Picture that happening in your business, a 36% decline in the entire marketplace. We might not have made it, frankly, through that kind of decline had we not been focused on these initiatives. They have been the difference in our company.
But why? How have they made a difference at those tough times?
It's back to what I said earlier. You know, our people have pulled together around this. There was never a thought of turning back when we were in the deepest part of this recession. Never a thought. Because we could see the business that we were getting, a lot of it was coming because of the goodwill we were generating in the marketplace. We had a Japanese sales manager called up one day, said, you know, I just got an order for 60,000 square meters. Now, that is a huge order from a Japanese company. And the woman who's closest to the president of the company heard you speak in Chicago and came back home to Japan and said, we have to buy a carpet from this company. God, you know. And when that kind of word gets around the sales force, you know, you really have a sales force turned on by this idea. So the business, we gain share, you know, in this downturn. And as we come out of it, we're stronger than ever. at the cost containment that we were able to manage the product innovations. I still want to come back to some of the product innovations when you'll give me
time.
No,
we should talk about those. Let me ask you a question, though. Are there times, though, over the last decade that you recall yourself saying, you know, I'd like to take that extra step to make this product or process greener, but it's just not going to pay off and I'm going to pull back?
Never. Never. Again, I'll give you a couple of examples. We have a factory in Southern California, lots of sunshine. The factory manager says, I wonder how photovoltaics would work here. So he scouted around. He found that there was state assistance for photovoltaics. And he asked his accountant to work out the justification. The accountant worked at it and worked at it. It didn't pencil. But the factory manager didn't give up. He went to his marketing people and said, do you think you could sell solar-made carpet? Something the world never, ever heard of before. And they said, bring it on. So we made this investment decision in the round, so to speak, not based on cost, but based on the overall appeal of introducing the next industrial revolution is what we were doing. And it has a million square yards a year now of solar-made carpet are going out that factory door of incremental sales that we might not have got. We made a lot of decisions early on when oil was $15, $20 a barrel that were very questionable. But today, with oil at $72, we're looking really smart for having done those things.
Lorraine, any cautionary tales or lessons learned that you think people should know about?
I think that our challenge is going to be to keep, even though we've made the commitment to how much we're going to spend in terms of innovation, and we will, that we don't get complacent because we've had good success, and I'm proud of the success we've had. We're sold out of wind turbines through 2008. We have 1,000 engine backlog for our most efficient engines that will fly on the 787 aircraft and the 777. We have our locomotives, the Evolution locomotive that is sold out fundamentally of 1,100 backlog orders. So when you have that kind of success, it can breed a little bit of complacency and say, well, we're doing really well. Why don't we just sell more of that? Mm-hmm. And guess what? We already have to be thinking about what's that next generation going to look like? And that's a little harder than when you're in a position where you're coming from behind. We've already got to be obsoleting those products. And while we're selling wind turbines like mad, we'll deliver 4,700 of them over the next 2 years. We're delighted. But you know what? They're still not as cost-effective as they need to be. And let's be honest, in the United States, without the production tax credit, there wouldn't be a single wind turbine sold, because in those years when there is no production tax credit, we sold zero in the United States. So that's a 1,300 wind turbine swing.
So a sign of what John was saying about the policy.
The policy is incredibly landscape. Important. And I think we can't get complacent that, great, we've got a nice three-year run here. Let's let things play out. We've got to be thinking about what's the technology for 2010 and beyond. And frankly, let me just take the example of an Evolution locomotive. That's a great locomotive. It's just going into operation now. We're already designing a hybrid locomotive that will make that look old-fashioned. So I think that's the challenge for a big company, particularly with multiple constituencies and multiple
Speaking of big, let me actually pick up on that. You have 300,000 employees across almost every geography. How do you take a program, an initiative like EcoImagination, and really bake it into the DNA of the company so that not just on the sales and marketing side, but on the innovation side, how do you get your research centers and your product development folks to be thinking about green demand in the market?
Yeah, a few things. First, I'm very fortunate in that our company works across divisions. We have something annually called our Growth Playbook, which is our strategic plan for the year. We actually have lead engineers who move from one business to another. And I'll just give you an example. The guy that used to run engineering at Aviation has moved over to our energy business. And you might say, okay, that's interesting, but who cares? Well, he just took all the brain power that he had from that particular product and moved it over to energy, where we also design gas turbines, but also those big wind turbines, it's just a big fan blade. So now all of a sudden we have that genius that comes with it and the ability to work across. And I spend a ton of time personally in the businesses and with the Global Research Center, where we have some of the most brilliant minds with 3,000 engineers in the Global Research Center, which, by the way, is in New York, Shanghai, India, and Germany. So we get the best minds from around the world telling us what is the cutting edge technology? Where should we be making these investments? So driving it sounds hard across 300,000 people, but it's easier because of some of the mechanisms that we have within our own company. The cultural norms, I'd also add, Andrew, it's I think pretty well known that we drive a lot of initiatives and we drive it throughout the entire corporation. So that culture helped. When we said we're going to do eco-imagination, people didn't say, no, we're not. They said, what is it? How do I do it? What are my metrics? And so I think that helped us a great deal in moving us through the company. But I would say probably the best champions, along with Jeff and the CMOs and the business leaders, has been the Global Research Center that germinate the seeds of innovation.
John, most people think of companies like Google and Amazon as pretty kind of asset light, you know, not having significant energy and environmental issues. But I think a lot of us recognizing in the era of $7 a barrel oil that that's not the case, in part because of the significant demands on data centers. And Sun, a company that you're on the board of, recently announced an UltraSpark processor chip, which is significantly more efficient. And they're marketing it as the most eco-responsible computer chip out there. Tell us how the IT industry could be impacted by this whole movement to try to find business value in green. Do you think there's real opportunity there?
Yes. And I'm drawing from anecdotes as opposed to having surveyed the whole IT industry. But my favorite example, and this is a very secretive company with respect to its technology, but this has been reported in the press, is that Google, which some people have speculated, has the largest network of computing power around the world. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of computers strapped together with dark fiber. That there's a piece in the New York Times by John Markoff that said the Google founders themselves engineered the computers because they couldn't find available in industry computers that were energy efficient to meet their needs. They actually strapped these things together with Velcro. And then more recently, there was a photograph that showed what's alleged to be, in fact reported to be, the next data center site for Google. And they located it next to a hydroelectric dam in the state of Washington, where there used to be an aluminum refinery, a smelter that had gone out of business. Because financial analysts will tell you that the largest single operating expense at Google, after the salaries of those smart engineers, is their electric bill. Their electric bill. So the world of computation is becoming increasingly energy intensive. And so people like Sun, who have started to sell processing power on a watts per MIP basis, not just dollars per MIP, but how many watts will be generated, because you have to cool these data centers, are finding it's an important competitive advantage. It's a necessity.
Great. So we have a whole audience of people here who I think have questions. I see one here. I'm going to ask you to keep your questions really short, because we started a few minutes late. We have about 10, 12 minutes left, and let's start right here.
Okay, thanks. Three quick comments that I'd like a reaction from the panelists. First, and I'll go a little bit against the panel here. Point number one, corporate green is an economic oxymoron. Corporations are fiduciaries. We're talking about free goods, air and water, and they have a fiduciary obligation to use as much of them as laws will allow, in my view. Point number one, I'd like a reaction to that. Point number two, there is great confusion between corporate green and the price mechanism. It slips into much of the discussion here about, yeah, I did this, made this investment at $70 oil. I look brilliant. The price mechanism did the same thing in the late 70s and 80s. Government did, I think, exactly the wrong thing, backed products like synfuels and coal gasification and the like. And OPEC brought the price of their product back down to where substitution was no longer economic. So
okay,
confusing price agreement. Point number three is, I think the best thing corporations can do to be green is to advocate market mechanisms like cap and trade and globally fungible trading markets where they can efficiently invest in green technologies and sell their credits.
Thanks. Ray, do you want to address that?
I don't know whether you're right or wrong, but I'm trying to invent a better way to make a bigger profit and finding that it's not only the right thing to do but the smart thing to do as well.
Ray, what's the interplay between the moral imperative of doing the right thing, which obviously I think was your main motivator when you started, and the business imperative to drive profit from green.
The power's with the people, and the people in our marketplace were asking these tough questions early on, and we responded, and they have embraced us, and it's turning out to be a better way, and reducing that environmental footprint is part of the value proposition that we're offering our customers, and they're accepting it.
Any other responses? Let's get some other questions. Right here. Yes. Is there a mic?
Mike, I have a lot of voice. I just wanted to, I'm glad that GE is doing what it's doing, but when you started talking about the amount of money that you're investing in green, it's what percentage of your vast...
One third. Of our research and development will be in green technologies.
No, of your whole company.
That is of the whole company. We spend about $5 billion in research and development today, and we will, when we reach $1.5 billion, that will be one-third.
Okay, because it sounded so small when you were talking about...
Billion.
Okay.
$1.5 billion.
Okay, I thought you... Maybe,
is that small?
Maybe I
well,
thought you
know,
said...
You know what they say, a billion here, a billion there.
All of a sudden you're talking real money.
Yeah,
we are in Aspen after all. This question right here.
My question is, what are the major green building components that are now being used or planned to be used in construction of new buildings? Just the major components where there's application to green.
In buildings,
you want to talk about that quickly, right?
Yeah. Energy efficient mechanical systems, lots of insulation, the newest kind of glass, triple pane glass, and in-floor air distribution.
I would just add energy efficient lighting, of course.
Lighting, of course.
Also, of course I'd add that, wouldn't I? Efficient and economic use of solar, because it's, as Andrew pointed out earlier, sometimes that's tough. And in some cases, in very large installations where there's both a heating and a steam need, perhaps, like hospitals and large teaching institutions, cogeneration and the ability to generate energy from waste gas and waste products.
And then there are finishes that, that produce off-gassing that you do not want to use. So VOC-free finishes.
Great. We have lots of questions. I'm going to aggregate three questions. If I can get the people, the mics, to go to three people right here, this gentleman, this lady in the tan, and then Joel in the back. So let me have your question, please.
It's about the developed world is on a stagnant population growth, and the developing world is growing very vastly. I know it's a dirty word to say, but for corporations, is there really profit to be made in introducing leapfrog and new technologies within the developing nations?
Great. Yeah. Second question?
My question has to do with how you measure the footprint, the ecological environmental footprint that you're talking about. The example that John gave about cheap hydroelectricity in the Northwest, which will be a driver for Google in the future, that there's a price that comes with the cheap electricity, which is the dams that have ruined the salmon runs in the Northwest and killed most of those rivers. So if you draw the footprint big enough, it's a little harder to get all the way green.
Okay. Second, and then third.
Thank you. Much of what you've been talking about is how to grow or in some cases create new markets for green products and services. Lorraine alluded to the role of production tax credits with wind as one of the driving forces, in other words, at the policy level. I'm wondering what you see the role of your companies is, not just the role, but the obligation of your companies to work at the policy level to try and level the playing field on oil prices and all of the other things that are, in some cases, impeding the growth of the products and services you're looking to do and make and buy and sell.
Okay, great. Who wants to address those? Bottom of the pyramid, footprint, policy?
I might try two of them, or at least one. I'd like to start on this green footprint, because I was tromping around in the Amazon rainforest a couple of weeks ago with a leader from Conservation International. We saw all this deforestation. It's inevitable. What can we possibly do? And he said, John, one of the biggest single levers that we have is companies like, and this is the point of this panel, companies like GE, companies like Walmart, their own actions, and most importantly, their supply chain. So actually, the green footprint of Walmart is enormous. They're the largest employer in the United States. They consume more electricity than any private business in the United States. And their supply chain is 30,000 other businesses. They're the largest single trading partner in China. So when they decide to do something because it's profitable and the right thing to do, there's no, and by example, GE and Walmart, there's no better way, faster way to move private industry, corporate leaders in the world than to have such successful organizations declare this is a priority. So I think that's the green footprint that matters. No, Google didn't pay to have a new dam built. And you're not suggesting that either. But the dam's there. The water's flowing. It's renewable. And seeking those smart sources of renewable energy is a great example for them to set. I could talk about policy, but I think we've covered that.
Yeah,
so.
It
does depend on where you draw the boundaries, for sure, by footprint. We live by the rule that we are our entire supply chain. No company stands alone. So as we talk about reducing our own environmental impacts, across the board, in terms of toxicity, energy, material usage, cutting the oil umbilical cord to Earth, all of those things, we're talking about an entire supply chain.
Lorraine, yeah, quickly.
And I would say, you know, from our perspective, you spoke about the wedges. I think about also technology and wedges. And there isn't one solution. There's no silver bullet. Hydro, all the renewables, wind, I mean, they all have their place and their appropriate mix. We might even throw nuclear into that mix, although I recognize it has its own set of issues. We have to have diversity because we see what happened to the prices of natural gas, although if that goes down, that will again be, you know, a reasonable technology. So I think, and coal gasification as well. So, I mean, if we do nothing, we are going to have pulverized coal plants by the hundreds developed in this country and everywhere else around the world, including China and India. And until we signal, and this is back to the policy question, that there will be a policy coming, we'll have a jailbreak of that technology getting embedded, and once it is, it's a 50-year asset. So we will live with the results for 50 years. So we have to be, yeah, until we die, in that's a prescient statement. So I think from a policy perspective, we absolutely have an obligation to get out there. We are doing so. What we say is that, you know, we want it to be something that the United States can live with from an economic development perspective. It's the only policy that will fly, frankly, and it's the only policy we should want to fly. But it has to be in the context of the global environment. And the final thing I'd say is your question about developing countries. We've just signed an MOU with the NDRC, which is the Central Planning Community for China. And they aren't trying to quickly develop dirty technology. I think that's very old thinking. In fact, what they call their 5-year sustainable plan is green GDP. And they've partnered with us in EcoImagination to think about how they do their infrastructure build-out. I mean, what a perfect opportunity for us to seize that and say, yes, let's think about the diversity of fuel choices that you make. How do we do everything from making their aviation, which is growing faster than anywhere in the world. It's growing 10% per annum. That's enormous, and the footprint that comes with it could be enormous. So how do we convince them to buy the best technology there? How do we convince them that they should be only developing cleaner coal technology? We've just expanded our wind operations there, and they are ahead of us in many ways. And as a global company, we have to share the perspective of certainly, first of all, the EU, where there's an emission trading scheme, and we have facilities under that trading scheme. The United States, where we are a little stymied in terms of what's going to happen. We need some certainty in terms of policy. And then maybe the other extreme, where in the developing world, where in some cases they are ahead of everybody.
I think we have two more minutes. Let me get three new questioners, 1, 2, and Vinod, 3. Very quickly, we're going to throw out the questions, let the panelists pick the ones they want to answer.
Yeah, I'm interested that green is the new red, white, and blue, and it reminds me of the comment that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. There's a lot of that in the green movement. And I see green movements, environmental groups, who do fundraising brochures and all of the rest of that and ultimately take positions that are anti-environment in the name of whipping up emotion, just the way there are groups that do fundraisers and whip up emotion in the name of patriotism that, in fact, are taking positions that are that are bad for the country.
Do you have a question?
Can you talk about your relationship with some of the more radical and vocal environmental groups, like those, for example, who stopped the creation of a tidal energy plant in Alaska because they said it would somehow interfere with the flowing of the fish, which in fact it would not?
Okay. Second question? Yep.
Yeah, question for Lorraine, and I guess I fear I'm going to be a skunk in the party here, but I think what you're doing is to be applauded. Obviously, we wouldn't be here if we didn't feel that way. But a lot of us also feel that environmental responsibility applies not just to trees and atmosphere, but animal welfare. In fact, Jane Goodall was one of the keynote speakers here last year, and of course she was wildly loved, as she is around the world. And she and virtually every other animal welfare organization in the world are literally begging corporations to stop using exotic animals, especially baby chimps, in their advertising. And I wonder if you will make a comment on your use of that in your own advertising.
Okay. Third question. These are diverse.
I just wanted to give Ray an opportunity to tell us about the products.
Great. Thank you, Vinod. Good.
Appreciate it.
Okay. I see one other burning one. Yeah, this is going to be the last one.
I just think a lot of these doubtful people here segue into my question, which is how, for Lorraine, or any big corporation in the world of, that we have such mistrust of corporations right now, how do you persuade a disillusioned America in that sense that you are going for a higher purpose as well as just for profit?
Good. Okay, good questions. Ray, you want to start? Say a little bit about those products?
Yeah, our lead product designer named David Oakey read Janine Benyus's book, Biomimicry. Nature's teacher, nature's mentor, how would nature do this, that, or the other? Quick example, the kookaburra was the inspiration for Velcro. Okay, nature's teacher. And he did the outrageous thing. He sent his design team into the forest and said, go and see how nature would design a floor covering. And don't come back with leaf designs. That's not what I mean. Come back with nature's design principles. And they did, and they realized in the course of a day that you look at the forest floor and there's no two things alike. No two sticks, no two stones, no two anything. There's chaos here, but there's an orderliness in the chaos. Call it chaotic. They came back to the design studio, they designed a carpet tile such that the face design of no two tiles was the same. All was similar, but everyone was different. Totally contrary to the industrial paradigm that every mass-produced item must be the cookie cutter same. They introduced this product into the marketplace as entropy disorder, and in a year and a half it went to the top of the bestseller list faster than any other product ever had. There was almost no waste, no off quality in production. Inspectors could not find defects among this deliberate imperfection of no two alike. The installer could install it very quickly because he didn't have to worry about getting the nap all running the same way. He just put it down on the floor the way it came out of the box. The user could truly rotate the carpet on his floor the way he does the tiles on his car and make individual replacements of damaged carpet tiles. There was no dye light issue any longer. Dye lights could be merged indistinguishably, which meant you didn't have to carry a shelf stock of the original dye light, you know, waiting for that emergency. And yet, there was more. And I finally figured it out. There's someone on the environmental speaking circuit who begins every speech by having her audience close their eyes and picture that perfect place of serenity and repose, creativity, comfort, that perfect comfort zone. We might do it here. Imagine that perfect place. Close your eyes. In your mind's eye, that perfect place where you would go for repose, for comfort, security, that creative place. How many of you are somewhere indoors? Almost no one ever raises their hands. We human beings gravitate to nature. And in a way, I think that entropy brings outdoors indoors in a subliminal way, and that is its real appeal. There's power in biomimicry. And by the way, there's a term for that. It's called biophilia. And you've got Edward Wilson who coined that term speaking sometime.
That's right. E.O. Yeah. Wilson will be here. Thank you. Lorraine?
I'd love to take on the question from the back about skeptics and cynics, and perhaps people have to deal with legacy issues, and any industrial company will have their share of those. Let me start by saying the first power plant in the United States was at the Pearl Street Station in New York City, and it was one of the dirtiest plants in the world, and that was a century ago. Yes, that was GE equipment. So, of course, when you're a company that is 127 years old, you have legacy issues, and we have them as well. We have issues, and I won't whisper it. Everyone knows we've had issues with the Hudson, and what we have to do is make sure that we are complying with everything that the EPA has asked us to do and going the extra mile to ensure that those things happen quickly, and that we don't have any more of those incidences in the future. But we are a huge corporation with a global footprint, and we have to address those legacy issues in a very timely manner. But eco-imagination is all about the future. It's about thinking about where we are going to go. And I think as a somewhat of a balance to those cynics, I'd say that's why we said we have to also lead by example, not just create great products that provide commerce for us, but also by way of example to say we will voluntarily lower our own greenhouse gases, that we will voluntarily lower our own electricity usage. And so, yes, we do get a benefit from that by lower electricity costs, but at the same time we're also making a big statement. And so far we have worked on about 500 projects across the company and lowered our footprint by 250,000 tons of CO2. So I think you have to do both. You have to deal with the issues that you've created, even in times when it was not illegal to deal with PCBs. Deal with those. Deal with them in a quick and compliant manner. But you can get so stuck in the past, and I think there are lots of people that would love for us and other companies and investors to be stuck in the past, and you just cannot allow the cynics to drag you backward.
Great. John, any final thoughts?
The final thought is we need new voices in this policy debate. And I think when the leaders of corporations go to Washington, D.C. and say, we need these changes, when the global leaders talk about other global policies, Kyoto, improved, whatever it is, that really makes a difference. So innovation, supply chain, policy, and the leadership from the group that we're talking about in this sector, the corporations, are what we have to applaud, support, and call for more of. And my final call, again, I can't tell you how impressed I am by Andrew, the articulate way that he's led this conversation, and maybe you'll join me in a round of applause for him.
Well, that's the reverse of the way it's supposed to end. Thank you to this terrific panel. Ray Anderson had a couple more comments. I invite those of you who want to continue the dialogue with this terrific group to come up and chat with these leaders.
Can I just ask you?
Sorry, Ray.
That's okay.